Chapter 28. The year 1880, Aqua was still alive somehow, somewhere, was to prove to be the most retentive and talented one in his long, too long, never too long life. He was 10. His father had lingered in the West where the many-colored mountains acted upon Van as they had on all young Russians of genius. He could solve an Euler-type problem or learn by heart Pushkin's Headless Horseman poem in less than 20 minutes. With white-bloused, enthusiastically sweating Andrei Andreevich, he lolled for hours in the violet shade of pink cliffs, studying major and minor Russian writers, and puzzling out the exaggerated but, on the whole, complimentary allusions to his father's volitations and loves in another life in Lermontov's diamond-faceted tetrameters. He struggled to keep back his tears while A.A.A. blew his fat red nose when shown the peasant bear footprint of Tolstoy, preserved in the clay of a motor court in Utah, where he had written the tale of Murat, the Navajo chieftain, a French general's bastard, shot by Cora Day in his swimming pool. What a soprano Cora had been. Demand took Van to the world-famous opera house in Telluride in West Colorado, and there he enjoyed, and sometimes detested, the greatest international shows. English blank-verse plays, French tragedies in rhymed couplets, thunderous German musical dramas with giants and magicians and a defecating white horse. He passed through various little passions, parlor magic, chess, fluff-weight boxing matches at fairs, stunt riding, and of course those unforgettable, much-too-early initiations when his lovely young English governess expertly petted him between milkshake and bed. She, petticoated, petty-titted, half-dressed for some party with her sister and Demon and Demon's casino-touring companion, bodyguard and guardian angel, monitor and advisor, Mr. Plunkett, a reformed card-sharper. Mr. Plunkett had been, in the summer of his adventurous years, one of the greatest shulers, politely called gaming conjurers, in both England and America. At 40, in the middle of a draw poker session, he had been betrayed by a fainting fit of cardiac origin, which allowed, alas, a bad loser's dirty hands to go through his pockets, had spent several years in prison, and become reconverted to the Roman faith of his forefathers, and, upon completing his term, had dabbled in missionary work, written a handbook on conjuring, conducted bridge columns in various papers, and done some sleuthing for the police. He had two stalwart sons in the force. The outrageous ravages of time and some surgical tampering with his rugged features had made his gray face not more attractive, but at least unrecognizable to all but a few old cronies, who now shunned his chilling company anyway. To Van, he was even more fascinating than King Wing. Gruff but kindly, Mr. Plunkett could not resist exploiting that fascination, we all like to be liked, by introducing Van to the tricks of an art now become pure and abstract, and therefore genuine. Mr. Plunkett considered the use of all mechanical media, mirrors and vulgar sleeve rakes as leading inevitably to exposure, just as jellies, muslin, rubber hands, and so on sully and shorten a professional medium's career. He taught Van what to look for when suspecting the cheater, with bright objects around him. Christmas tree, or twinkler, as those amateurs, some of them respectable clubmen, are called by professionals. Mr. Plunkett believed only in sleight of hand. Secret pockets were useful, but could be turned inside out and against you. Most essential was the feel of a card, the delicacy of its palming and digitation, the false shuffle, deck sweeping, pack roofing, prefabrication of deals, and above all, a finger agility that practice could metamorphose into veritable vanishing acts, or, conversely, into the materialization of a joker or the transformation of two pairs into four kings. One absolute requisite, if using privately an additional deck, was memorizing discards when hands were not prearranged. For a couple of months, Van practiced card tricks, then turned to other recreations. He was an apprentice who learned fast and kept his labeled files in a cool place. In 1885, having completed his prep school education, he went up to Chowes University in England, where his fathers had gone, and traveled from time to time to London or Lute, as prosperous but not over-refined British colonials called that lovely pearl-gray sad city on the other side of the Channel. Sometime during the winter of 1886-87, at dismally cold Chowes, in the course of a poker game with two Frenchmen and a fellow student whom we shall call Dick, in the latter's smartly furnished rooms in Serenity Court, he noticed that the French twins were losing not only because they were happily and hopelessly tight, but also because Milord was that crystal cretin of Plunkett's vocabulary, a man of many mirrors, small reflecting surfaces variously angled and shaped, glinting discreetly on watch or signet ring, dissimulated like female fireflies in the undergrowth, on table legs, inside cuff or lapel, and on the edges of ashtrays, whose position on adjacent supports Dick kept shifting with a negligent air, all of which, as any card sharper might tell you, was as dumb as it was redundant. Having bided his time and lost several thousands, Van decided to put some old lessons into practice. There was a pause in the game. Dick got up and went to a speaking tube in the corner to order more wine. The unfortunate twins were passing to each other a fountain pen, thumb-pressing and repressing it in disastrous transit as they calculated their losses, which exceeded Van's. Van slipped a pack of cards into his pocket and stood up, rolling the stiffness out of his mighty shoulders. "I say, Dick, ever met a gambler in the States called Plunkett? Bald, gray chap when I knew him."
"Plunkett? Plunkett? Must have been before my time. Was he the one who turned priest or something?"
"Why?" "One of my father's pals. Great artist."
"Artist?"
"Yes, artist. I'm an artist.
I suppose you think you're an artist.
Many people do."
"What on earth is an artist?"
"An underground observatory," replied Van promptly.
"That's out of some modern novel,"
said Dick, discarding his cigarette after a few avid inhales.
"That's out of Van Veen," said Van Veen.
Dick strolled back to the table. His man came in with the wine. Van retired to the WC and started to doctor the deck, as old Plunkett used to call the process. He remembered that the last time he had made card magic was when showing some tricks to Damon, who disapproved of their poker slant. Oh yes, and when putting at ease the mad conjurer at the ward, whose pet obsession was that gravity had something to do with the blood circulation of a supreme being. Van felt pretty sure of his skill, and of Milord's stupidity, but doubted he could keep it up for any length of time. He was sorry for Dick, who, apart from being an amateur rogue, was an amiable, indolent fellow, with a pasty face and a flabby body. You could knock him down with a feather, and he frankly admitted that if his people kept refusing to pay his huge and trite debts, he would have to move to Australia to make new ones there and forge a few checks on the way. He now constatait avec plaisir, as he told his victims, that only a few £100 separated him from the shoreline of the minimal sum he needed to appease his most ruthless creditor, whereupon he went on fleecing poor Jean and Jacques with reckless haste, and then found himself with three honest aces, dealt to him lovingly by Van, against Van's nimbly mustered four nines. This was followed by a good bluff against a better one, and with Van's generously slipping the desperately flashing and twinkling young lord good but not good enough hands, the latter's martyrdom came to a sudden end. London tailors wringing their hands in the fog, and a moneylender, the famous Saint Priest of Chowes, asking for an appointment with Dick's father. After the heaviest betting Van had yet seen, Jacques showed a forlorn couleur, as he called it in a dying man's whisper, and Dick surrendered with a straight flush to his tormentor's royal one. Van, who up to then had had no trouble whatever in concealing his delicate maneuvers from Dick's silly lens, now had the pleasure of seeing him glimpse the second joker palmed in his, Van's, hand, as he swept up and clasped to his bosom The Rainbow Ivory. Plunkett was full of poetry.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please insert disc number 6. This is disc number 6.
Vaughn, who up to then had had no trouble whatever in concealing his delicate maneuvers from Dick's silly lens, now had the pleasure of seeing him glimpse the second Joker palmed in his, Vaughn's, hand as he swept up and clasped to his bosom the Rainbow Ivory. Plunkett was full of poetry. The twins put on their ties and coats and said they had to quit.
"Same here, Dick," said Vaughn. "Pity you had to rely on your crystal balls. I have often wondered why the Russian for it, I think we have a Russian ancestor in common, is the same as the German for schoolboy, minus the umlaut."
And while prattling thus, Vaughn refunded with a rapidly written check the ecstatically astonished Frenchman. Then he collected a handful of cards and chips and hurled them into Dick's face. The missiles were still in flight when he regretted that cruel and commonplace beau geste, for the wretched fellow could not respond in any conceivable fashion, and just sat there, covering one eye and examining his damaged spectacles with the other. It was also bleeding a little, while the French twins were pressing upon him two handkerchiefs which he kept good-naturedly pushing away. Rosy Aura was shivering in Green Serenity Court. Laborious old Cho's.
"There should be a sign denoting applause,"
Ada's note. Vaughn fumed and fretted the rest of the morning, and after a long soak in a hot bath, the best advisor and prompter and inspirer in the world, except, of course, the WC seat, decided to pen. Pen is the word, a note of apology to the cheated cheater. As he was dressing, a messenger brought him a note from Lord C. He was a cousin of one of Vaughn's Riverlane schoolmates, in which generous Dick proposed to substitute for his debt an introduction to the Venus Villa Club, to which his whole clan belonged. Such a bounty no boy of 18 could hope to obtain. It was a ticket to paradise. Vaughn tussled with his slightly overweight conscience, both grinning like old pals in their old gymnasium, and accepted Dick's offer.
"I think, Vaughn, you should make it clearer why you, Vaughn, the proudest and cleanest of men, I'm not speaking of abject physicalities, we are all organized that way, but why you, pure Vaughn, could accept the offer of a rogue who no doubt continued to flash and twinkle after that fiasco. I think you should explain, primo, that you were dreadfully overworked, and secondo, that you could not bear the thought that the rogue knew, that he, being a rogue, you could not call him out and were safe, so to speak. Right? Vaughn, do you hear me? I think..."
He did not twinkle long after that. 5 or 6 years later, in Monte Carlo, Vaughn was passing by an open-air cafe when a hand grabbed him by the elbow, and a radiant, ruddy, comparatively respectable Dick C. leaned toward him over the petunias of the latticed balustrade.
"Fan," he cried, "I've given up all that looking-glass dung. Congratulate me. Listen, the only safe way is to mark 'em. Wait, that's not all. Can you imagine? They've invented a microscopic, and I mean microscopic, point of euphorion. A precious metal to insert under your thumbnail. You can't see it with the naked eye, but one minuscule section of your monocle is made to magnify the mark you make with it. Like killing a flea on one card after another as they come along in the game. That's the beauty of it. No preparations, no props, nothing. Mark 'em! Mark 'em!"
Good Dick was still shouting as Vaughn walked away.